Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back this week to Anthologies of Hope for episode number 4. Thank you everyone for all the feedback, the comments, and all the downloads. We're really blown away by your reception of Jen John's story from last week, and I know she's very thankful for all you taking the time to listen. It means the world to us to hear from you at Anthologies of Hope, to be able to share these powerful stories and have them land on the ears that need to hear them. If this is your first time listening to Anthologies of Hope, I'm Rick Osowski, and I'm excited to be back for another week. I hope you'll join us for many more stories that we have planned to share throughout the year. As always, I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. As mentioned in the first couple of episodes, the first few seasons of our podcast will cover conversations with members of the HeartCamp family. If you're not familiar, HeartCamp is the brainchild of Jamie Tworkowski, and it's a two-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. For more information on HeartCamp, including upcoming dates like the one in February 2019 that is currently having active enrollment for Melbourne, Florida, you can check out heartcampwithjamie.com for more details. If you want more details on HeartCamp and how it was the catalyst for this very podcast, be sure to check out the first two episodes and you'll hear more in my intro there. Also, if you're a member of the HeartCamp family and want to share your story, we want to hear from you, especially the folks from the Nashville sessions. We've gotten plenty of feedback from everyone, but the Florida and the LA contingents definitely stand out. So we're still looking for some of our Nashville folk to stand up and participate. So please hit us up on the contact page at anthologiesofhope.com to let us know. Our interview this week is with Jenny Gillies, the proud Canadian attendee from the First Heart Camp in January 2018. There are a few stories that you'll hear over the course of our time on Anthologies of Hope that were the genesis or the catalyst for the podcast to actually come to fruition. Jenny's story is at the top of that list. She has an amazing grasp of her story and tells it with wisdom far beyond her years. She is one of the biggest and fiercest hearts I've ever known. We touch on Jenny's struggles with depression, coming to terms with her physical disability, albeit as she puts it, mild, anxiety, suicidal ideations, and being an only child attempting to overcome imposter syndrome. I never really plan to have any surprising plot twists in our episodes here at Anthologies of Hope, but if you're paying attention, you're in for one over the course of Jenny's counseling experience, and looking back, she and I both find it quite hilarious. You may notice some background noise here and there throughout the episode, so don't adjust your headphones. We just happened to be recording while Jenny was in an all-out WWF wrestling match with her comforter. If you joined us last week, I mentioned that we're putting together a playlist available at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist that hosts and guests of each episode can contribute meaningful songs to. You'll hear Jenny's at the end of her episode. My song this week should come as no surprise to Jenny, as I couldn't choose anyone but some of her countrymen for her episode. Thanks to one late-night YouTube music video rat hole a few years back, I discovered Marianas Trench, a pop-punk band very successful north of the border, but only recently coming into my view on YouTube and Spotify shuffles within the past few years. The song is one that I can't listen to without wanting to start belting out, and the music video is one that I can't watch without tearing up a bit. The band actually took the money for the music video and put most of that money into many of the local community charities instead of making a big, overblown music video, since I think they only play music videos in Canada still. So be sure to check it out on YouTube to see all the love there. The one part of the song that gets me every time is the end of the second verse that goes, "I won't come back to you broken. I won't stay away too long. Even if words I've spoken seem to still come out wrong. I'll get my shit back together, get right where I belong." If that isn't the exact mission statement for Anthologies of Hope, I don't really know what is. So I'm excited to add Marianas Trench's Who Do You Love to the Season 1 playlist. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of topics potentially difficult to hear. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you're in a more positive season. If you're in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages of To Write Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help. and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. Both of these are amazing organizations that will help connect you with the resources necessary for the type of help you need. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter at AnthologiesPod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Please like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Google Podcasts, pretty much anywhere you find podcasts. And if there's a place you're listening to podcasts that you're not and you somehow found us here, let us know and we'll get at it there. If you want anyone in the world in your corner fighting for you and having your back, it's Jenny. And I'm so very grateful to have her on the podcast this week. Ladies and gentlemen, Jenny Gillies on Anthologies of Hope.
Hey guys, my name's Jenny. For those of you who don't know, I live in Canada. Pretty cool place. I had to do a lot of work to get to Heart Camp. It's all part of the journey. So I got to meet Rick there, which was pretty cool. We've done a lot of adventuring in the last 300 and almost 65 days since then. It's been a ride.
And I mean, it's been quite a ride even before that. You've had quite the journey getting up. You said, I mean, you had quite the journey getting to Heart Camp, but even so, you had quite the journey getting up to even thinking about Heart Camp. So what are some of the things that you've dealt with in the course of your mental health journey and some of your just getting to where you're at now? I mean, you've had a lot of big changes this year post Heart Camp. So I imagine we'll jump into that as far as being the inspiration for some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I just really love Heart Camp, so I feel like it's always my go-to, but I suppose we could talk about my life before that.
BHC and AHC?
Yeah, exactly. That's actually really funny that you say that. So one of my favorite authors is John Green, and my favorite book that he's ever written is called Looking for Alaska. Yes, I know that they're making a movie. No, I don't want to see it. No, I don't want to talk about the characters. We'll get into that later on. Anyway, the way that the book is structured is there's a before section and there's an after section. And I read the book for the first time when I was 14 or 15. It was the summer between finishing eighth grade and starting high school, because we don't have middle school where I'm from. It always really interested me, the whole like idea of before and after. And then I started high school and everything was great and it was all good. And I thought I was really well adjusted. And then in January of 2013, I unofficially graduated high school because I went back for a fifth year to gain some credits that I lost when I went on a trip to Europe. So I went back for four and a half year. I'm not really sure. But I finished in January and didn't like walk across the stage till June, but I was done high school. I never really like prepped myself for that transition. I mean, at that point, I knew all about like chaotic transitions. So I never... The idea of preparing myself for things to change just never occurred to me. And then it was January, it was winter, it was cold, I had zero routine, I had zero job, I had a fairly rocky relationship with my mom, seeing as I was living in her house and not working. And looking back now, I understand that for what I saw as anger and frustration and disappointment in me was actually just like fear for what she didn't know what I was going to do. And she was a single mom. So like, it's not like she could just throw money at me and be like, here, I support you. So I totally get that now. Also, my dad doesn't live with me. My parents have never been together. He's a pretty heavy drinker. I'm the only one in my family who will admit that he's an alcoholic. But I mean, that's how I cope and that's how they cope. So there's that.
Yeah, that's a rough position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. And I've gone to a lot of therapy for it. But I mean, it's fine. So that winter, so like when I finished high school, I was 18. It was also the same time that my mom was fighting my dad for child support, like back pay, because he was a drunk, didn't pay child support. And she was a single mom, and I totally agree that she believed, like, she was in her own right to fight for child support because, like, she needed money, and I get it. I have mad respect for that. However, growing up just my mom and I my entire life, I was really kind of, and this isn't to complain, this is just like a statement.
Statement of fact. I mean, sometimes you just have to, sometimes they sound similar, but sometimes they are the, you know, it's a statement of fact, nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah. This is a statement of fact. It also just kind of sounds like a complaint, disclaimer. Growing up with just my mom and I was really forced to grow up rather quickly, because it was just the two of us. And my mom, she had friends, but like we spent the majority of our time together. Oh, in my hometown, like describe us as peas in a pod. If she goes somewhere without me or vice versa, they're always like, where's the other one? Because that was just how it was. And I was happy with it. I mean, it was what I knew, but I also was up until this point in my life, at like 18, I was fairly proud of our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She was really a role model for me. And then, so I was like secretly struggling with the fact that I was not in school and didn't have a job and didn't have money. And so I couldn't say anything because my whole life my mom was like, you're a strong kid, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I also guess I didn't tell any of our listeners or your listeners, they're our listeners for this episode. I have cerebral palsy. That just never came up in the description of me. It's really mild. It basically just affects, like, the left side of my body, kind of like I had a stroke. I will get into more detail as we go on. I'm going to try and do this in a...
chronological order?
Yeah, thank you. I couldn't remember the word. In a chronological order, just so I can, like, remember. But we will come back to the cerebral palsy. It's just relevant for this moment. So my mom, my whole life had been like, you're a really strong kid. You can do whatever you want. Like anything they can do, you can do too. And I was like, yeah, mom, like inclusion. I'm into it. She also was like, hey, man, like you got to be strong. She never explicitly said those words, but that was always like the understanding between
thoroughly us. Implied.
Yes, thoroughly implied. So, yeah. So I never told her that I was struggling with the transition because it felt dumb. Everyone, at 18, everyone's like, high school is the best years of your life. And then when you're graduating, everyone's like, university or college, what are you going to do? Like, you've got your whole life ahead of you. And I was like stuck in this in-between of the quote-unquote best years of my life being over and no future plans for what the rest of my life that lies ahead of me. Like, no, I don't know. And my mom, at the same time, was dealing with this whole custody battle. And, you know, in movies, so she was really stressed out. So, you know, in movies, like for cinematography effect, I don't think that's a word, but we'll go with it. They do the thing where there's like dramatic music and then the main character is like having a moment of realization and they like zoom in and it's really dramatic.
Yeah, like that's the epiphany.
I had one of those epiphanies. I think that's a word. I think I've read it one or two times. Moment where my mom came home. I will never forget it ever. My mom came home from being in court with my dad all day. I don't know where I was. I must have been at home being a sad sack of crap. Because that's how I spent like 4 months after high school. I literally just laid in my bed and cried and my mom ignored me or yelled at me to get a job, which makes her sound like a really terrible person. She was just coping the best way she knew how.
Exactly.
Home from this court date with my dad where they were going to decide custody. And She came home, and because my mom and I are very similar, she just has to talk about everything to process it, which I appreciate now, and then I also appreciate it. However, in that exact moment, I didn't appreciate
it. That was the worst possible time and way to process that for that exact moment, yeah.
Yeah, because like she started sharing things about how it went down, forgetting that I am the child that they're fighting about. That is my father, and she is my mother.
Yep.
Those are just, like, that's how it is. So she was just talking at me, and I said the appropriate response that fell out of my mouth, how did it go? And she said, your father's an asshole. And I said, yeah, that's a statement of fact, like relative fact, mm-hmm. depending on who you're talking to. And then I said, why, what happened? Because that's what you say when someone says that, except there was no like filter in my brain where I was like, this is your mother, don't ask her these questions, she has friends for this. But no, I want to help everyone. So I said, what happened? And she said, the judge gave an amount of child support that he had to pay, and his lawyer, or my lawyer, said, don't forget, Your Honor, like, the child at hand has a disability. And his lawyer countered with, yeah, but it's not very severe. I don't think it should play in to how much money you get for custody. And my mom said that, and then I had that moment of epiphany where I was the only person I was mad at in that situation was my father, because A, he didn't know me well enough to be like, hey man, it does affect her daily functioning. And yes, she is worthy enough of a person for me to pay like the
extra sufficient support
for $4. Yeah, like whatever it is. But he didn't do that. So because I am the way I am, I just went to bed and I didn't say anything. And I literally internalized the fact that my dad hated me for, like, probably 3 years. I always, like, thought so when I was younger, just because he didn't ever give a fuck about me. But then that was internalized, and I was like, hey, man. And then that is the exact moment that I would, like, stick a pin in on a map. And someone was like, when did you get depressed? It was literally that moment. You know in movies when people sneeze and like they show the sneeze and it like hits the other person and then the other person is going to get that disease?
Yeah.
That is what that felt like.
Like a CSI flashback or overview?
Yeah, yeah. Without like the spittle or the blood speck.
Yeah.
But yeah. So from that moment I was not like really super open about how I felt, which is hilarious because you've met me post heart camp and now I'm very open about how I feel about all the things. We'll get to that in a minute, friends. But yeah, so I internalized that and didn't have a job and it was just really a lot. And it was also winter in Northern Ontario, which makes anyone depressed.
Yeah, you're not going to go outside and be happy and look for the sun and go running around and anything anyway. So just kind of compounding layer upon layer upon layer. So that's not good.
Exactly. I mean, for a dude from North Carolina, you kind of know what Canada's like. Wait, you live in Chicago now. It's basically the same thing. But yeah, so that compounded. And then first time that I'd ever like seriously contemplated suicide, I was never going to act on it, but it felt like a safety net, mm-hmm. which was really alarming to me. Like something would go wrong and I'd be like, oh, it's okay. You can just kill yourself. And then I'd be like, oh, okay, it's cool. Like, no, that's not a healthy coping mechanism.
Agreed.
I mean, it was a coping mechanism nonetheless, but like not one that I would recommend for anyone. But because I live in a small town and because my mom is my mom, we didn't talk about mental health ever. Like, it was not, I was a little bit of an advocate because, like, I'm a human and I, like, get it. But then once I started experiencing my own issues with my mental health, I was like, hey, man, this is, like, a real thing. So I called my local So in Canada, we have Canadian Mental Health Associations. It's like a nonprofit, but it's a Canada-wide thing.
Okay.
So I called. This particular one in my hometown offers free counseling. So I called. Was the scariest thing I had ever done in my entire life, still to this day, was picking up the phone without my mom home. Because I had to do it in secret, because she just kept asking me what was wrong with me. And I didn't know, because I had no idea.
So about how long had this been after that conversation, after that court date and that night that your mom came home?
Okay, so she came home in February. The court date was in February, and I called in April.
Okay.
So I had struggled for like a good number of weeks being like, nah, man. I did confide in my best friend, but I mean, she was going to school, so I didn't really want to be a burden, which I think is, and by think, I mean, I know is a common reason for people not to reach out. You don't want to be a burden, and I totally get it, but like friends, be a burden. Because you're not actually being a burden at all. So I have a really wonderful best friend who I was like, hey man, I'm going through this stuff. And she's like, it's okay, we'll figure it out. And I think that is the statement that like kept me going even before I called to ask for counseling, is that we will figure it out. It was never like, oh, you'll figure it out. The whole time I knew that we were in it together, even if we were 10 hours apart from each other and all I had was phone calls and really late night text messages. But I mean, that's everything.
That goes more than enough for a lot of people. So yeah, that's it. When you using that inclusive term to say, yeah, we will figure it out, we will do it, we'll get you the help, that can go a long way.
Yeah. And my favorite part of that really awful time in my life is that she was like my life jacket, because I wasn't obviously going to my father because I wasn't speaking to him, because in my mind he hated me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to my mother because we didn't talk about mental health, and she was the monster who just so callously announced that my father didn't love me. So like I was just doing my own thing, being an independent sad sack.
Yeah.
So when I finally got around to calling for counseling, I called in April, and the intake worker said, like, what are you dealing with? Like, what would you like to discuss in counseling? So I told her. And then the next question was, are you experiencing thoughts of suicide? And I was 100% undoubtedly, but I was scared to admit that to a stranger on the phone. So I said no. Because that's the wise thing to do. It's not the wise thing. When someone asks you if you want to kill yourself and they are a safe person, like a registered mental health worker, say yes.
Yeah, honesty is the best policy there, especially if you've already taken the leap and that you've crossed that threshold of making the call initially. Then you want to be as honest as possible, because that's why you're doing it in the first place. That's why you're going to get the help you need.
She's like, there's a wait list. She's like, but are you experiencing thoughts of suicide? And I was like, no, I'm perfect.
That's why I'm calling, but I'm perfect.
Yeah, I'm perfect. I've never been better. So I called in April, and their first available appointment was in August. So I agreed.
That's quite a long time, though.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, that's great. Never been better. So I took that appointment, and then summer came and I felt a little bit better, and I worked at the summer camp that I'd worked at for literally my whole life. So that summer I just pretended like I was normal, like the last 4 months hadn't happened and everything was great. And then school started, like my first year of university, I started counseling. My counselor, we did a lot of work regarding my dad and depression, and we talked about a lot of things, which was great. And then we started this routine where we realized that school was very stressful for me. School is not a good atmosphere for me. I really like learning. I really like being in a classroom setting where I can have discussions with other people, but like the whole deadlines and being judged on assignment, no.
And specifically graded and all of that stuff?
No, I don't like it. No, it's bad. So we did this thing where I would go to counseling every 2 weeks, which made me feel very normal, like quote unquote normal, because I had talked by now. I was like, yeah, I go to counseling. And I like had talked about it a little bit more with a few more people. And they said, oh, when do you go to counseling? And I said, oh, every 2 weeks. And they're like, oh, that's like pretty infrequent. And I was like, you're right. I don't have to go to counseling every week. And I was like, hey, maybe I'm like more normal than I thought I was. That's pretty great. So then I like took that little bit of light and I held on to it. And then we did a thing for the next 3 years where I would go from September to June and then take July and August off because I was working at summer camp and I never had a day off. Actually, my only day off was Sunday. So like, that's awkward. They weren't open on Sunday. And I mean, camp was the place where I felt safest and I felt the most me and I felt the most validated ever in my whole life. So I didn't need counseling. I willingly forwent, thank you.
I don't know.
Forwent my spot and gave it to someone else who might need it, who was on the waiting list for those 2 months. She kept my file open and I came back in September. So then I was in my second year. I went counseling one of these times and my counselor said, we like had a session, it was great, and she said, she always used to make the joke that, Jenny, stop telling me everything is fine when it's not, because before you know it, you're going to develop an anxiety disorder. And I laughed and laughed. I was like, ah, I'm already fucked up enough. Like, I don't need, no, I'm fine. I'm great. Like, shut up, Carol. So whatever, and that was the end of it. One day we had a session, and I was like, Kate, when's our next appointment? And she was like, I have some appointments and stuff that I need to figure out, so, like, I'll call you. I was like, okay. But I was in school, so I got busy and forgot about it, and I was in, like, a kind of good headspace. And then at the end of camp, like, in August, I called to make an appointment for August, and she just wasn't getting back to me, which was really weird. And yeah, I was like, okay, really weird. And then I called again, and somebody new answered the phone. So I was like, hello? And she was like, hi. She's like, Carol's out of the office for an unforeseen amount of time, whatever. But there's a new person. Would you like an appointment with her? And as much as like everything inside me was screaming, no, you don't want to start over, I said, yes. I was like, sure, I'd love that. Like, I need it. Sure. I started with this new girl. I really liked her. We really hit it off. It was really fantastic. I felt really safe. Like, it was a very smooth transition.
Which is always good.
Yeah, which I was really into. So we talked about things, and I kind of, like, had to give her the lowdown. But then, because I had done so much work previously about, like, my relationship with my dad and being a cliche girl with issues with her dad, I then realized that I had, like, a lot of internal, like, self issues. And it was as sad and awful as that sounds, it was also kind of cool to be like, hey, look, like I fixed this one problem that I thought was the root of all of my issues. And look, I've discovered like, no, like I'm a person aside from that issue, person who has issues nonetheless, but like still a person. So that was really cool. So then we started talking. We'll fast forward to my third year of university. So I met with her in the summer before third year, like August or something. And then school started and I got busy. We started talking about the fact that I definitely do have an anxiety disorder, which then made me laugh because I said, oh man, Carol called this and this is so funny. She looked at me and she said, she had a really weird look on her face. I was like, is everything all right? Which is like weird to ask your counselor. Yeah. Like, I feel like the roles had switched for a
minute. But again, another position you were in with your mom, so that, you know, should be nothing new.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, is everything all right? And she was like, you said Carol's name. And I was like, yeah, is she like Voldemort? Like, she who shall not be named? Like, what's the deal? Yes, I said her name. And then she was like, did anyone like tell you about Carol? And I was like, tell me about Carol. She was like, fuck, nobody told you. And I was like, well, my counselor just swore. So, like, this should be good.
Yeah.
Tell me about her. She's like, so I just wanted to let you know this is a permanent position for me. She was being really weird, and I was like,
it's always like dancing around the issue very much without trying to say anything about it.
I was like, cool, congratulations. Like, I don't know what you want me to say. She was like, Jenny, I don't know how to tell you this like smoothly, so I'm just gonna say it. I was like, okay. And she's like, Carol's dead.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, okay, all right, so that's cool.
Okay, yeah, that's a lot to, leading up to that, that's a whole lot to kind of be exposed to that reality in that way.
Yeah, so I was like, cool, like, up until this point, I knew that people died, like, I've been to many a funeral. A guy I went to high school with died in the second year of university. He was coming home and he got in a car accident and that was the end. So, like, I get it. People die. But, like, it was a really surreal and strange feeling for me to be like, this woman that I didn't know but knew everything about me and was, like, really a wonderful person in a time of awfulness is dead. And I didn't get to say goodbye. I didn't know she was sick. Like, it was just really weird for me to wrap my head around. And I was like, okay, cool. Good chat. Like, thanks for letting me know. So then, because I'm me, it struck me as really funny. Like, now I'm the girl who started counseling and has had two counselors because the first one died. Like, okay, sure. That's a really good story.
Yeah.
So I laugh about it because I'm a horrible person. Just kidding, I'm not. That's just how I cope with things. And I realized that even if she was here, she would be proud of the progress I made. So then for me and my current counselor, we then would be like, oh my God, like Carol would be so proud. And we would like talk about her. And it was really funny. It became a thing. So in September of 2015, I went down south. So I went to the Toronto area for those listeners that don't know where the South is or think the South is Alabama. I went to Toronto for a charity walk, and we do it every year. My mom and I go, and I remember sitting on my bed. I've always known that I have been very attuned to how other people feel and like how the world feels and just like the overall mood. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time. Well, not the first time. But this was, like, the most prominent time this has ever happened to me. So, my fellow listeners, be prepared for a story that either you'll relate with or you'll be like, man, she's wild. So I was sitting on my bed doing homework, and it was a particularly unanxious day, which, like, didn't really happen for me ever. So I was like, it's cool. Everything's good. Like, I mentally made a note while I was doing homework that I was, like, chill. Everything was cool. Then I got up off my bed and went pee and came back to my room and sat on my bed, started doing homework and said to myself, just randomly, I wasn't thinking about anything other than how good it felt to not have to pee anymore. And then into my brain popped this thought, holy shit, you can't go away this weekend. When you come home, someone's going to be dead. So I literally like stopped what I was doing and looked around.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck I was looking for, but I was like, well, okay. All right, cool.
That's one hell of a premonition.
Yeah, seriously. So I texted my friend and I was like, dude, I am texting you this so that there is like tangible proof that I had this thought. And he was like, okay. I was like, I was just doing my homework, not anxious one bit. I had to pee. So I got up to pee and then I came back and I thought to myself, I can't go away this weekend. Someone's going to be dead. And he was like, dude, I love you. And I know that you are anxious all the time. But like, even if you do go away, you can't stop that person from dying. And I'm like, I know you're right. But like, now I'm anxious. Like, now someone is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm uncomfortable. For the record, it should be noted, I didn't feel that I was going to kill anyone or anything dramatic. I just knew that someone was going to die. So whatever, I went away because, like, what were you going to do? 2014 was the year that Troy Love on Her Arms did their World Suicide Prevention Day of You'll See Me Tomorrow Because. So that was also the year that I moved into a house with a roommate. And because I wasn't living with my mom, I felt a little bit more freedom to talk about everything that I had dealt with mental health wise. So that was the first campaign that I ever participated in. I knew about To Write Love vaguely from like friends and other people.
Word of mouth and everything.
Yeah, and like I had never, up until like this point, I'd never been like, I'm someone who struggles with mental health issues. I was like, that's like a thing other people do, and I like whatever. Mm-hmm. I wasn't shaming anyone. It just felt like a demographic that I didn't,
that you weren't a part of.
Yeah, which was totally not the truth. So this was the first time that I participated in it. I shared this, and it was the first time that I like openly shared my full story. It definitely wasn't as in-depth as the story I'm currently telling you, but it was like the like less factual version, not lies, just like less facts.
Omission.
Yeah. So I shared it, and before we went away, I remember there was a lot of like outrage that I'd done such a thing, because my whole life I was known as Happy Jenny. Everyone knew me as Happy Jenny. I was always smiling, always laughing. So there couldn't ever be anything wrong with me, right? That's how it goes. Well, I was honest. And then I had some people in my life tell me that I was being offensive to those that actually had mental health issues for sharing my story. It was one of the statements I was given.
Wow.
Which cut me down a peg or five, because like, it was already hard enough to be like, hey, guys, I struggle. And then have someone be like, nah, girl, it ain't real. I was like, oh.
That's unfortunate.
Okay. Yeah. So I went away, did the kidney walk, came home. No one was dead. 3 days later, my best friend's boyfriend had died by suicide.
Ooh, so, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a time. If any of you ever feel that weird sense that someone might die, I promise you're not crazy. It's probably true in some sense of the word, even if you don't know the person who will die, because our bodies are really good at knowing things innately. They just know, even if we don't want them to know.
Yep.
So Zachary died, and it was really sad. I was really fucked up for like literally until this year, I would say. So like 3 years. But I took it upon myself to make it my mission to be like, hey, man, I need everyone in the world to never experience this ever again, ever. So I did. I talked about it. I said things. I did things. I wrote my fourth year thesis on the importance of youth mental health programs in small towns and how important it is to include youth when creating programming, rather than just being like, here, we've got some sad kids, here's what we think will be good for them.
Yep.
Rather than asking them. So it was my thing. I mean, it's made a lot of people really angry and uncomfortable and a lot of other emotions, which like whatever, they can feel what they feel. But we've also found a lot of strength in like our community of people that also were affected when Zachary died. So it was nice to watch people come together rather than fall apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all fell apart individually, but like
still came together at the same time.
Yeah.
As opposed to just solely isolating and never seeing each other, never addressing it, never kind of being able to make it actionable.
We talk about it all the time. But also that same year, my cousin died by suicide, and we lost five other members of our community. So 7 people died in like 6 months. All of the funerals which I had to attend. So now, this is where I circle back to the comment that I made about John Green like 50 years ago. So there are, the way I see my life is before depression and after depression, before Zachary died and after Zachary died, which like are all very different, like individually. They're different from like one another as a pair, but also different individually. But also before and after heart camp. So Zachary died, and I was sad, and everyone was sad, and I was doing my part. And then I realized that I was afraid that everyone was going to die, like all the time. That was the way that my anxiety manifested, which was really annoying.
And no, I mean, with 7 people in 6 months, I don't think anybody could blame you for that. That's something where, again, 1 every 3.5 weeks, that's somebody that you have to deal with. So that, again, your brain would go there regardless of any other conditions to just kind of say, like, these pins just keep falling, what's going to be next type thing. So that, yeah, that's totally understandable.
Yeah. So I do this thing even now, which I'm slowly learning how to not do or to do less, where when something awful happens, I immediately become the person that has to hold everyone together, which is fine and great, but it means that I don't deal with my own emotions about the situation. Zachary died in September 23rd. I found out he was dead. I drove home from the school, and I don't remember a single thing after that for 8 months.
Oh, wow.
But there's just like a large period of time in my brain that I have no recollection of. Luckily, I have had a really wonderful roommate at the time who is now more like family. But I mean, when you know someone for 3 weeks and then have to be the reason they stay alive for the next 8 months, like, you get pretty close real fast. So apparently I drank a lot, and like, I remember drinking a lot. But like, when I ask people about it, they tell me that anytime they suggested that we go to the grocery store, I would just get in my car and drive to the liquor store.
Yeah, when grocery store is synonymous with liquor store, there's a problem there.
Yeah, but like, I talked about it in counseling, and like, we were very, like, I never drank at work and I never drank at school, but like, I drank heavily in between both of those things. As long as I didn't have to drive, I was drunk, because it was just easier. I didn't want to deal with any of the shit that I had to deal with. And I was trying to, like, not drop out of school, which was already hard enough before everyone died. So, like, there's that. Mm-hmm. But I still made the dean's list that year. So, like, there's that. But, yeah, so I would joke about it in counseling. And she would be like, wine isn't your best option, but, like, it's also not your worst option. So, between the two, just keep drinking the wine. Just, like, don't get behind the wheel and, like, drink some water and we will deal with all of the emotions you are avoiding when you are capable of dealing with them, which will probably be after school ends. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. As long as we both have acknowledged that, like, I am on purpose not dealing with these things to be able to function, and we're just, like, getting me through, then it's cool. We're on the same page. But the more I talked about it and the more I dealt with it, it got easier to be like, mental health is a real thing, death affects everyone, there's no reason for me to be ashamed at how afraid I am of everyone to die. Like, there was a long time in my life, and still sometimes even now if I'm having a bad day, where I won't fall asleep until every person that I love tells me that they'll see me in the morning.
I've had those type of nights. I completely understand.
Yeah, I go through like a list of text messages I have to send, and if they see you in the morning, I'm like, hi, hello, do you still love me, are you still alive, if you're not alive in the morning, I'll kill you, like. But everyone knows that I'm neurotic and anxious, and like, that's the thing that I really struggle with. So everyone's fairly gracious about it, which is nice. And I mean, I try to not get too frustrated at myself, but I mean, I'm human. And then I was doing really well, and things were doing great, and I graduated in June of 2017, and I was healing, and I was talking about things, and I was being a person. Fall came around of 2017, and I have since then discovered that I am someone who's affected by seasonally affected disorder, which doesn't surprise me in the slightest, living where I live.
Yeah, exactly.
So the fall came, and then my brain fell to pieces, and I was sad and not really sure what I was going to do with my life. And then Jamie Korkowski announced Heart Camp, and I was like, yes, girl, I need to go. I need to go right now. Like, I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't even know what it is, but I have never known. I called my friend, and I was sobbing. And she was like, I don't know why you're crying. And I was like, because I need to go to this. And she was like, okay, we'll get you there. And I was like, no. I have not known something to be so true since I knew that someone was going to die the week Zachary died. Like, I have to go to heart camp. I don't even know what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I'm going to get there. I have no money. I don't even know how it transpired. I looked at the website, looked at how much it would cost, got really anxious that I didn't have enough money and that it was going to sell out, like, instantly. And I was like, no. You're going. You have to go. Like, everything will be fine. It will all work out. So then my best friend is a couple and family therapist. And he loves Jamie as much as I do. So I called him and was like, oh my God, this thing is happening and I don't know how I'm going to go. And then he texted me back and he was like, I'm paying for you. And I was like, what?
Wow.
You're going because I'm fronting the money. Like, you can pay me back when you have the money. And I was like, holy fuck, is this real? Like, this isn't real. Well, I had to get a new passport between November and heart camp. And
as I remember, you cut that extremely close.
Yeah. So, friends, when you see something or when someone says, you should get a passport in case, like, something cool happens, don't put it off. I know they're expensive, but get a fucking passport. So I got my passport literally the day before I flew out to heart camp. It came in the mail. I've never been so excited to see a male person in my whole life. I probably could have kissed them.
I'm surprised you didn't tackle them.
Seriously, though. I think I did scream, like, as they were driving away and, like, jump up and down. I was like, thank you so much! So, heart camp happened. I got to meet Sierra DeMolder and so many great people. And Jamie's nephews. Oh, man, I love the nephews. Oh, frig. Heart camp was the first time since the summer camp that I worked at closed that I felt a safe place, like a place that feels like home without even trying. No matter where it is or what is happening,
mm-hmm.
I feel good. Then, because it's really weird as an adult. I don't know if you experience this at your heart camp, or maybe you're just better at it, at being a social human. But I find it really weird introducing myself to a group of people as an adult who, like, could potentially be my friends.
I was just thinking this either last night or earlier this morning, where I need to get some sort of shirt that says, hi, I'm an extremely introverted extrovert. So that, again, if I,
yeah.
It was definitely last night, because Amanda and I went to Conversations Cafe at Hope for the Day, which was at Sip of Hope, and yeah. It was an amazing night of mental health conversation. But there were plenty of people there where I always hesitate or just don't introduce myself to people. But as soon as they introduce themselves to me, it's like we could talk all night, be best friends type thing. And so I don't know what it is where I just don't ever introduce myself, but I need to make that known so that it's like, hi, come talk to me and I'll talk to you, but it never gets going.
Right. So I am very much the same, but it's not because I'm introverted. I've realized it's because I have zero self-worth. Like, I don't think I'm cool enough.
Well, for me, it ends up being an imposter syndrome scenario.
Conversation with me.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really weird as an adult to also be like, because it has been 5 years since I started counseling, 5 years since I've been diagnosed, like 2.5 since I've been on meds, and I still don't think that, like, it's not even denial. It's not that I'm denying that I struggle with depression or anxiety or PTSD or any of the things that, like, are a label for me. It's not denial. It's that I'm like, yeah, but other people have it worse.
Mm-hmm. So is that in a way where, in saying other people have it worse, where you're okay with where you're at with it, but you don't need to work on it as much because other people have it worse? Or is it that, like, where do you go from there?
Like, okay, so other people have it worse, so it felt really weird to be in Florida with 41 or 42 other people who understood mental health, like, regardless of whether they've experienced it firsthand or know someone who has dealt with mental health issues. It was really weird for me to, like, say things out loud that I am hesitant to say and mm-hmm. have people be like, oh, yeah, I totally understand.
Which is the complete opposite wow, experience of the walk that you had earlier and a lot of the people telling you about not to.
Right.
Yeah.
So I am always, like, hesitant on, like, how to approach it or how to share it. Because I am, as you know, and as your listeners can probably tell from this interview, I'm pretty high energy. Like, I'm pretty easy to get along with. I'm fairly happy. And, like, if I know you well, there's a good chance I will, like, punch you in the arm if I'm excited. So, like...
Very good chance.
Or, like, stuff. Like, really whatever. So it's always weird for me to be like, yeah, this is who I am. But also, like, I have a physical disability. And... my head is kind of a mess sometimes. But then I'm always like, am I complaining or am I stating facts? But in my head, it feels like I'm complaining. But out loud, like to other people, I've realized I'm just stating facts. It's like if you told me that you have a beard and no hair, I'd be like, yeah, cool. I know.
That's the point we have to get to where it's that level of acceptance where, again, it's statement of fact but not complaining, where it's like if you walked into a door and you're like, ow, my elbow hurts, like, again, it's statement of fact because of something that happened. And then obviously,
right,
like, you can see the physical scars but you can't see the buildup of the mental scars. So that's where we end up getting that
right.
stigma and shame associated with sharing our mental state because it's something that's not, you know, physically or readily apparent.
Right. And I think this has come to me in the past, like, year or less than a year. I think I'm so hesitant to share what I deal with mentally because I'm in, like, the gray area of there are days that I am really good. And then there are days that I am really bad. And there's also days where I'm in between and it's just, like, it is what it is. And that makes me human, but also I'm in the gray area of having a physical disability. So I think I have imposter syndrome, and we've talked about this in counseling a few times, but I have imposter syndrome because, and, like, not everyone fits in, like, black and white boxes. I understand that's how life works. But, like, I'm so in between any kind of classification for most things in my life that it doesn't, like, I don't feel worthy of being like, yeah, I associate with this group of people or, like, this condition or, you know?
I know more than you know because I didn't jump in on this from the beginning of the story, but very similarly, I mean, it was something where my parents were divorced. It wasn't as negative as of a separation as your parents, but I lived with my dad from 6th grade on, and he busted his ass to give me everything that I ever needed. So there wasn't anything that I was lacking, but I did spend a lot of time alone. And so I was very self-sufficient, very much I took care of myself. I, you know, usually made myself dinner, would end up doing just, I would spend a lot of alone time. And so I learned to be very self-sufficient at a young age. That continued on through high school, that continued on through college, that continued on through after college. And so it's something where that ends up being a case where it's not often where I'm in a situation where I'm doing something as far as constructing, building, or delivering something with somebody else. So it's usually, again, all me. And so when I bring myself into a situation, it's like, oh, I'm the only reason I'm here. I have nothing to offer. I have nothing value, or like these other people, like they're more open or they're kind of talking about it, or yeah, they have real problems. So that's more of that as opposed to
100%.
And so, yeah, that's the exact 100% kind of match for the imposter syndrome that I deal with on a regular basis. And it's something where I've talked about through both of my therapists, in multiple friends. I'm trying to think in other avenues as well, but it ends up being, yeah, the exact same space where due to all of that and then kind of showing up and being like, do I want to jump in? And then if I jump in and nobody responds, what am I going to do? Do I just kind of stay back and like let everything else take course and then try to jump in once there's something established? So yeah, it's something that is definitely a strobe light in my brain as far as the biggest piece of what's going on there.
I get that. And I have the added thing of being an extrovert where I am genuinely as happy as you think I am all the time. Like, if I'm having a good day, I am having a good day. But I get really nervous that people think that I'm being ingenuine if they tell me something and I'm like, oh my God, that's the coolest thing ever! And I genuinely think it's the coolest thing ever. Mm-hmm. But that's not the, like, standard for reaction. When you meet someone new, I'm the kind of person that, like, jumps right into new friendships. Like, feet first, I mean, head first, like, all in. If there's rocks at the bottom, I'll figure it out later. Yeah. Kind of thing.
All you see is green flags.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, green flags, new people, woo! And we'll figure it out later. And 9 times out of 10, I'm right. I mean, and, like, whatever, that's life. But it is a really weird time to be like, hi, this is who I am. The only benefit that I, like, the only, like, upper hand, I would say, I feel like that's a bad use of the statement. Maybe we can figure out a new word. The only perk, I would say, of being me and going to Heart Camp is that because for every Heart Camp, he starts a Facebook group with all the attendees, and we got to introduce ourselves. Everyone knew that I was the only Canadian going. So that was something that I'm very sure of. Like, mm-hmm. I am Canadian. Yeah. There's no...
Nobody can take that from you. Like, that's something that you're 100% able to stand on and own, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, exactly. And my hair was bright pink, and I was like, I don't know where I'm gonna, what I'm gonna do. And I'm not really someone who's shy, but like now as an adult and really being able to read body language, I'm like, oh God, I don't like meeting new people because like I can feel them judging me or I think they're judging me. It really depends on my mental state when I meet people, but I feel like that's how it is for most people. But so Heart Camp was really cool in the fact that I got there and I was nervous. I mean, I took an $88 Uber ride from Orlando to Melbourne.
I did not know that.
I had some time to make friends with my Uber driver who was Haitian and super cool.
I did not know that even 10 months into this. That's awesome.
So the only way that I could get there was to fly into Orlando, but I had to fly in at like 10:30 at night and I didn't know anyone. So I had to take an Uber and like I had budgeted for it, but I was still like, holy mother of Jesus. I was also like a little bit shy and people had been really generous to get me there because like I said, I didn't know how I was going to get there. So I once again felt like a burden asking anyone for anything. So I literally just budgeted to spend almost $100 on an Uber because I didn't want to inconvenience anyone. So the moral of that story is anyone who wants to go to future Heart Camps, make friends. Just do it. It'll save you money.
Yeah.
But it was really cool because I was rooming with Miss Candance. And so we had been like corresponding and I was really excited to meet her, but it was still like meeting a new person, right? Well, she had the entire, when I got there, she was running across the lobby to hug me. She hugged me so hard she almost knocked me down. Like literally I had to hold on to her to not hit the ground.
That
and there
awesome.
Was just a group of people in the lobby and like I walked in and I said, and like my eyes got like teary, and Candace was like, I'm so happy you're here. And I was like, it took me forever to get here. I didn't think I'd ever get here. But like now I'm here and it literally feels like home. I don't know a single person in this room, but I have never felt more safe than I do right now. And then we sat down and chatted forever. And then Katie wormed my recently written slam poem out of me about the fuckboy who ghosted me. And then I wrote a book about it. The moral of my story, I would say, or one of the morals, is things are hard. I get it. Things suck. I am not discrediting that for 1 second, but I also believe in magic like you wouldn't believe. Like, things happen that are awful, but on the flip side, things happen that are so goddamn beautiful, it takes your breath away. And this is one of those statements that I say, and people are like, she's crazy. She's been snorting Hallmark cards. And I'm like, I know I sound crazy, but let me tell you, as someone who has dealt with a fair bit of self-image issues and body image issues, and someone who actively struggles with body dysmorphia, and bet you didn't know that about me, fun fact.
I'm right there with you.
Having a drunk dad and separated parents and never really understanding love from birth feels like, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I really honestly believe in the power of friendships. They can change the world, man. They're magic.
That goes along with one of my favorite quotes from one of Man and I's favorite comedians, who we've seen live a couple of times, but on one of his specials, he says, to believe in miracles, you just have to kind of redefine what a miracle is, and it's the universe still showing you that it can surprise you. And so I think that's very beautiful and goes in line with what you just said, where, yeah, things are hard, but believe in magic because it's still there. You'll have things that'll surprise you. You'll have people that'll surprise you. You'll have people that'll surprise you in a bad way, but more often than not, it's going to far outweigh in a positive, and you'll end up seeing it the far greater positive than any of the negative.
Yeah, and if you are struggling with anything, I mean, if you're struggling with what to have for lunch, text your best friend. Be like, I don't know, man, grilled cheese or a sandwich. Like, what do I eat? Because guess what? Your best friend is your best friend for a reason. Mm-hmm. Losing as many people as I have lost in the past couple of years, I now define friendship whereby, is this person someone I can call when someone dies? Which is a horrendous thing to think about. But, like, in all honesty, in the middle of the night, if someone dies, who can you call?
But it's a great quantifier to be able to be objective about that. So, yeah.
Those are your people. Those are the people that will do anything for you at any time of the night, no matter what it costs. And I just happen to have found a large number of those people all at one hotel one time in the last 10 months. And if you think that you are stuck and that your life is going to be this shitty forever, I promise you it will not. Things change rapidly. If you could have told me that I would want to go to Heart Camp, sign up to go to Heart Camp, get a passport in the nick of time, go to Heart Camp, have a truly life-altering time, and then come home and have the people that I thought were my support system tell me that I was joining a cult and that they were worried about me, and have my entire support system at home burn to the ground for me being an advocate, I would have told you you were crazy, because that's just the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Seems ridiculous.
However, that happened, but now it's been however many months since April, because I'm not good at math. My life is entirely different once more. I'm now living in the city of my dreams, 737 steps away from the ocean.
A published
working
author.
With dogs and coffee and, oh yeah, I'm a published author. I forget that part.
So by the definition, it was life altering.
Yeah. Like, I don't, it's not even December yet. So in the last 10 months, my life has done multiple full circles. My life is currently doing burnouts in a parking lot.
Going loop de loops.
Yeah.
So mentioning the published author piece, why don't you go ahead and give yourself a little plug for your book there?
All right. So I'm a published author, all thanks to some people in a lobby at Heart Camp and a dude who fucked me over one time. Just kidding. Multiple dudes who fucked me over. My book is called Ghosts of Fuckboys Past. It is available in hard copy on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, The ebook version is available wherever ebooks are sold. My Instagram handle is HollowLeggedHazel, and my account, I will accept most follows because I like people who like poetry. And I mean, you don't know this about me now, but I'm a ragey soapbox feminist who will fight for the right to experience pleasure.
That seems like a good right to fight for. One question that I've got going, and so I'll ask it first and then give you some Jeopardy music time to think of it, since it wasn't in some of the other stuff. But what is one song, or it can be multiple, since everybody I say that's one song, and the first response is, can it be two? But what is one song that you'd want to share about your story?
1,000%. So the first song would 100% be, without fail and not even having to think on it, Dead Sea by the Lumineers.
Excellent choice.
Because that is my favorite metaphor for love. And for anyone who doesn't know the song, you don't have to be in love for this song to matter to you. I tell my best friend all the time that she is my Dead Sea. She is the reason I am still here, and she is the reason that I refuse to leave, even on the days that the darkness is like, bitch, you gotta go. And I'm like, no. The second song that I would choose would be, it's called Someday the Moon Will Be Gold. It's by Cale Matson. He's a Canadian singer-songwriter who is originally from my hometown. And he is the musician that I found in the depths of my depression. And he is really melancholy and really sad because he sings about losing his mom at 16. But dude, he gets you. Mm-hmm. Like, he sings things. And I have never listened to a single one of his songs without crying. And I know every word to every song. But that song is one of my favorites because he's right. Someday the moon will be gold. If that is what you've got to hold on to, let that be the thing. The only thing that I would want to say that's left is, if you are someone who struggles with a disability of any kind, be it invisible illness or very, very visible illness, and you are also struggling with mental health, that does not mean you are weak. It just means that your brain has realized that you got a lot of shit on your plate. So it's okay to get help. It's okay to feel sad about the body that you live in. But on the days that you don't feel sad about the body you live in, it is entirely okay to feel proud about the body you live in. And you are not an imposter. You are not faking it. There are parts of your body that you can love and still have a weird relationship with. It's okay. It happens.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.